afternoon, everyone. Calling to order the June 18, 2019 meeting of the Rental Services Commission. At the outset, we have meeting minutes from the May 21st meeting. I will entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
I move to approve.
Second.
Okay. Should I have done roll call before the just realizing.
It's okay. We'll do it after.
All right.
It's at nap time.
It's almost summertime. So all in favor of approving the May meeting minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Opposed.
Or abstentions? Okay, unanimous. We'll now do a roll call. We'll go around the table and then hit the folks on the phone. I'll start. Ian Davey, present.
Deborah Hemsley, present.
Leah Sykes, present.
Laura Gulino de Lovato, here.
Mike Ness.
Jessica Greenley.
Okay, great. Alphabetically, Margot Black.
Oh, Margot, here, present.
And Katrina Holland.
Present. There's an echo.
Yep.
And static.
I don't know where the echo is coming from. It's never done that before, to my knowledge.
Is it...
I hear it on my side, but I don't know what that means.
I don't either. Sorry.
Katrina, it might be on your line. Does it make it difficult to participate?
No.
Okay. It is nearly summer, so that means meetings are either canceled or very quick. I am aiming to make this one very quick. So I'll just start with a staff update from Andres.
Great, thank you. I'm going to start with something that we did a while back, which is check-ins. So I've included this as a handout in your binders, more for you to be able to reference back, but you're welcome to go through it as we do. So what I did is I summarized the findings of the check-ins we did a while back. The PowerPoints are pretty detailed, but I will give a high-level overview. So the first one, which is everyone was asked what they've enjoyed from the RSC. Generally speaking, people thought the meetings have been a productive use of time, that the group has been able to have respectful conversations and engage in the policy process meaningfully. There are some more detailed answers about appreciating engagement, ongoing engagement from members, and the ability to build relationships as a group. The next question was about what could improve. So there was a sentiment across a number of people that the group's purpose or role wasn't always clear. That the relationship with council and communication from council could be better. And there was, as a lack of clarity arose from the purpose of the group, some ambiguity about what the group was trying to accomplish or how it would be functioning in terms of what was expected of group members. On if meetings are productive, people seem to largely agree that they're a good use of time, but there are a number of small points which people suggested coming back to. Some of them we've already started incorporating. So one of the requests was that staff make more suggestions to the RSC instead of just asking open-ended questions for the group to come up with to kind of prod engagement. People liked that we had extended meetings to be 2.5 hours instead of 2 hours, but there was also a reluctance to go beyond 2.5 hours. There were some thoughts about how it would be useful to have meetings later in the day and to invite more voices into the group, whether that is through invited testimony, increasing the amount of public testimony, or diversifying the input the group receives. Around how to engage, this echoed, I think, a lot of the points of the previous question. So people were interested in if there are ways to fulfill the role of the group as a public forum better, if it was possible to get more guidance from council, people thought it would be helpful to find purpose for the group if it was missing, so whether that meant going to council, returning to the founding language and documents. There were also some things in there about meeting management, so managing the time and discussion in the group effectively, and transparency. So one of the asks was to bring the results of the check-in to the group, which is why I'm presenting now. One of the questions was about if there was anything that surprised people and how people felt prepared or unprepared for the group. There was some initial surprise about the pace and variety of topics and how the purpose of the group seems to have shifted from when it was first founded to kind of where we are today. From that, some members felt like that shift has led to additional clarity, like the more time has gone on, the group has kind of found a rhythm, whether that is always clear or not, that it had gelled, to a sense. People also noted it was very different from the Relocation Technical Advisory Group for those who were a part of it. And then the last question was about if there was anything missing from the group. So this ended up largely being about perspective or voices. So a number of people shared a feeling that there needed to be more representation from people of color, from small-scale landlords, small-scale housing developers, renters at large or landlords at large. There was some notes about the need for consistent attendance, and I think those really centered on the idea that everyone at the table brings a very valuable perspective, and that when people are missing from the table, those perspectives are missing. Other ideas that came from it include the RSC binders, which we've implemented, again, returning to meeting management, having the Rules and Bylaws Committee meet frequently again, which we've also done. So a number of these we've begun to take steps to implement. A lot of these, I think, are going to come back to the work that the Rules and Bylaws Committee is doing. But I think it's important for everyone to have this, to be able to refer to it, and to kind of see where that input ended up coming together. Do people have any questions on that?
I have a quick question. How did folks, if you're comfortable sharing, indicate it was different from the Technical Advisory Committee for the mandatory relocation?
Mm-hmm. I think people expressed that there is more consistency with this group. Some people expressed that they felt like the RSC was less combative of a group, and also that there was more freedom to give input, and that it wasn't kind of a narrow technical input, but that it was a broader, the perspective of this group is being asked for in a wide sense of ways.
Was there anything, did anybody indicate there was something about that group that made it easier? And I'll use an example, which is the meetings I came to, we would go through, I mean, it was very formulaic, and so it made it obvious to kind of know what next steps were. So maybe the broader nature of this body doesn't lend itself to that, but that was just one thing that I was thinking of. I didn't know if there was more.
Mm-hmm. I think that there was a sense of clarity and structure to the technical group that people have felt is missing from the RSC. The other updates is that the fair ordinance is coming before council tomorrow at 4:15. Last week, council passed a number of amendments to that ordinance, and this is expected to be a final vote. We'll know more about the Housing Bureau's role afterwards, but at the moment, we're tasked with coming up with administrative rules to implement a variety of parts of the ordinances if they pass, and we will be engaging the RSC as we do that. At this time, we don't know exactly what that's going to look like because we don't have clarity on the breadth of administrative rules that will be created.
Andreas, can I ask a question about that?
Of course.
Because when RELO was passed and made permanent and the Housing Bureau needed to do administrative rules. We got the, you know, I remember Shannon coming and sharing the draft of the interim rules and saying that we would be very engaged in the process of the permanent rules. And my understanding is that those are about to be, a draft is about to be released, and then our engagement will kind of be the same level of engagement that the general public is. And that sounds very different than helping inform those rules at, you know, kind of the advisory level. And so I guess I want to ask whether or not we can have more advanced input on the administrative rules that will go with the fair ordinance.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely possible. I think one of the questions about the role of the group that could be answered is it would make sense, and I've checked in with staff about this, to bring administrative rules that the rental services office is developing to the commission for input, and I think that that's absolutely a reasonable role. So we're happy to bring those rules.
I mean, if it's not a role, that's fine, but then we need to clarify what it means to say the commission will be engaged in the process, because I had assumed one thing, and then really it's more like informed about the process, or informed about the outcome of the process rather than engaged in the process. So I just would like to manage expectations on that.
Definitely.
I just want to echo what Margo is saying about getting clarity on the RSC's role in with the fair ordinance after the vote. And as I think really just echoing what Margo said, to have some clear understanding of what the role is for this body, so that we're all on the same page and we can be the most effective and efficient.
I'll take that feedback back.
Thank you.
And on those, rules are approved by council, is that right?
No. Each administrative rule process can be different, but we generally do our rules internally, and they're approved by the director.
So is there anything from our charter that prevents us from, I mean, I don't think that there is, but we're advisory to council, so that's kind of,
okay. In the charter, I believe, the commission advises council, the housing commissioner, the director, and the housing bureau.
Right.
Okay. And then the last update is that Matt was scheduled to present parts of today's agenda, but has been asked by the director to attend a training at Prosper Portland. So I will be presenting all of today's agenda, and you will get to hear me talk a lot.
Okay, with that, we'll move into the regular agenda. Andres, do you want to present the 1920 budget?
Can I ask one more question before we move on?
Sure.
Some asset update.
Okay.
Folks know I'm going to have to hang up and call back in at 4 because I have a job interview, so I'll hopefully be calling back in at 4:30. So if I vanish, that's where I am. And then my other question was about the vacant seat on the RSC. I was just curious about the update on that. I want to mention Nick Cook and Garcia resigned. Those seats were filled promptly. Meanwhile, one didn't attend for the better part of a year, finally resigned, and I feel like it's been 4 or 5 months since that resignation has occurred, and I'd just like to know when we're going to get that, you know, kind of tenant advocate seat filled.
So we have lined up with a reconciling of the city's process on public advisory bodies. And so, as you might remember, the city's trying to standardize all of its advisory bodies, and a while ago put out a draft bylaws, which was to be the first step in a series of changes to make all advisory bodies more compatible. Since then, there has been some more guidance given, including a standardized application process. So we got caught in that timeline, as well as having some technical difficulties with the application that they were using that caused the application window to be extended. The application window has been closed. We have reviewed applications, created the shortlist, We're in the process of getting input from the executive committee. I have one call left for that. From there, staff will take the feedback that we've gathered to the director and the mayor's office, who will make a nomination, and then the seat will be filled. So that's where we're at with filling the open seat.
Does that standby is interface with our bylaw subcommittee, you know, bringing us feedback on how the group is going to work with regards to subcommittees and whatnot? Because my understanding with that was, you know, to create a subcommittee, say, focused on, you know, responding to public testimony, for example, that was postponed until the bylaws committee came back with some proposals, which, to my understanding, is still a couple months out. Is that interfacing with the standardized process of making the advisory bodies more consistent?
So those are two separate steps. The bylaws committee is revising the bylaws, which is going to line up with the city's advisory body bylaw template. But separate from that, in addition to the template, the city's developed a process to standardize advisory bodies, including applications. And so that's what we've been dealing with, not so much what the RSC bylaws committee is doing.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Of course. So with that, I will go into the budget. This is also available in your binders. I realize it can be a little bit small and difficult to read on the screen. The first page is a graphic that presents an overview of the Rental Services Office and its different programs. So you can see in the green how the level of funding for services as well as the FTE has increased every fiscal year since 2016-17. In that first step, you see the original contracts that eventually began to, was the starting point for the Rental Services Office. So historically, the Housing Bureau had a number of contracts around fair housing, as well as environmental health and safety. So those contracts have been around for a while and continue under the Rental Services Office. But in fiscal year 17-18, a number of new contracts were added or expanded. So there was additional funding around landlord-tenant education, legal assistance, culturally specific tenant assistance, safe housing project, One App Oregon, and a FED pilot. So the items in light blue are pilots, which means that they're intended to be a limited duration and sunset at some point in time. So in 17-18, that's when on the budget we can mark the beginning of the Rental Services Office. You'll also see shortly after that the Rental Services Commission begins. The next increase came in the 19-20 fiscal year. So there was additional funding for fair housing enforcement as well as another pilot on expungement. In this last fiscal year, so going into, or last budget cycle, going into 19-20, all current levels of funding have been continued. The expungement pilot is receiving additional funds from the cannabis tax, and there has been funding for a mediation pilot, as well as one-time funding to expand landlord-tenant education. I do want to point out that the mediation pilot came in direct response to the RSC letter on services and fee levels that requested exploring options for mediation, as well as hearing a response or a need for further training and education for landlords and tenants, which is where the additional funding for expanding landlord and tenant education came from.
Can I ask a quick question on this?
Of course.
Is the intention of the landlord and tenant education allocation to replace the BDS's landlord training program?
It is not intended to replace BDS's landlord training program. This is supplemental to it, and it's one-time funding.
Okay. Can I ask a question?
Of course.
And I'm just about to sign off, so I apologize if this is going to get answered later. But in terms of giving input on the existing funding that's been extended, I'm looking specifically at One App Oregon. for example, you know, they aren't listing affordable housing units. And I don't, I, you know, I personally would like to know why the city would continue to fund that when they aren't meeting those goals and, to my knowledge, not demonstrating any intention to. Like, the mission has kind of shifted a little bit. So how does one go about asking those questions and essentially trying to redistribute those funds to meet, you know, similar goals but in different ways?
I'm not familiar with the contract. Intimately, I don't manage it, but I can ask for more information and ask what's being done with that contract currently. I know that ONAP has a number of products for the private market. This contract was only dealing with the parts for affordable housing, but I can ask to see, to get more information about the scope of that contract and what the results have been.
But so
what,
that would be great, thank you. But then how does, like, let's say we get the results and we're like, oh, that, well, we don't like them. Does, what can we on the RFP do to influence, like, a reallocation of those funds potentially to, you know, a mechanism that meets those, you know, those stated goals and outcomes in a different way?
So, like I mentioned to Ian before, the RSC advises council, the director, and the bureau. So if the RSC has recommendations to make to the bureau or the rental services office about better uses of funds or the role of contracts, like the ONAP contract, it's welcome to make those recommendations.
Okay, great. That's cool. Thank you so much.
Of course.
But Margo, I mean, as a private citizen, you can engage in the process at City Hall, which
mm-hmm.
for this year has happened, but in the future, I do think that we could probably pull
up the town hall, but I found it seems like that's mostly, I guess I have struggled with knowing how to effectively engage in those, because, like, I went to the housing budget town hall and I saw very informative presentations by community partners that were providing certain services, and that helped me as a citizen to understand where the money is going. But I didn't, I guess I'm just trying to say, like, well, first of all, Tyrone or no one from ONAP was there to give such a presentation. But it's hard as a citizen to sort of know where you can give input. Is it on asking for new money? Is it on protesting cuts? Or, you know, can you go into what is already, the money's already being spent for, you know, spent on, and say, I think we should change that around a little bit. I hear what you're saying, Ian. Like, if that is the way to engage, then that's the way it is. I'm just saying that as a private citizen, that knowing how to navigate through the public budget process in that way has been kind of a mystery to me.
Yeah, fair enough.
So on the next page, we have a breakdown of the rental services office's programs and services in a different way. So there you can see the funding, again, by source. The dark blue represents existing funding, and the light blue represents one-time funding that's been added. So in the one-time funding that's been added, you can see the funds for expungement services and mediation services pilots, as well as funding for new training and education. We have not yet decided how that's going to break down. Within the new training and education services, we expect that there will be funds that will go out in an RFQ for landlord training, for renter training, as well as funds that will be retained by the office to do outreach and training, as well as material costs. And we don't know exactly what that breakdown is going to be. When we get to the RFQ, you'll get to see a little bit more of that. But that's just a placeholder for understanding what's going into that amount. On the next page, you can see a breakdown of the work of the rental services office by FTE. So the largest amount of time is spent on contract management. After that, relocation assistance for exemptions, as well as providing technical assistance on landlord-tenant law. Some FTE around staff and program management, and then smaller amounts of FTE on a variety of tasks, including the Rental Services Commission. So that's a breakdown roughly of how the 6 FTE in the rental services office is spread among different roles. Those don't line up one-to-one to positions. A lot of that FTE is pieced together to make each of the roles in the office.
Andres, can you go back to that last slide?
Of course.
Can you restate what you said about the bottom three? I think you said something about a placeholder. I just wanted to make sure I understood that.
So the new training and education services is a combination of funds that will be split between renter education and training, landlord education and training, as well as rental services education and training, as well as materials costs. And so that amount will be divided into three uses. We don't know exactly at what levels that will be or in what configuration, but it's not going to be, we're not putting out an RFQ for over $250,000. Some of that will stay in the office to cover costs and training, and the rest will be bid out in some form.
With what's coming forward in the way of the new rulemaking and some of the other obligations, the registration and whatever, have you guys done an analysis of what you expect to need in the way of FTE moving forward?
This is indicative of the coming fiscal year, so this is our best guess at what it's going to be, this is our best guess of what the FTE is going to be moving forward, but we recognize that changes in how rental registration happens, a role in the fare ordinance, all of these things would shift our expectations. So this is our estimate based off what we know right now. But in our office, just like with the commission, we have to constantly reassess and reconfigure.
You explained the bottom bar in the total funding buckets. Did you say expungement services has not yet been allocated?
So there was, I want to say $50,000 for an expungement pilot the current fiscal year we're in.
Yeah.
In the coming fiscal year, council allocated $100,000 in additional funds, which will come from the cannabis tax. Right. So it is going to extend the expungement pilot by adding money and also extending the end date. We also anticipate it's going to revise the scope because we want to make sure we stay consistent with the intent of the cannabis tax funds and the purpose that funding was created for. So we're going to do some realignment to make sure that the way we're doing an expungement pilot also aligns with the priorities for the funding. But we will be continuing our expungement pilot with some revisions moving forward.
And do you know who the recipient is?
So we currently have a contract with Metropolitan Public Defenders for the contract, and we anticipate that they will continue doing the legal services for the pilot. We're trying to understand or trying to decide where to go with some of the input we've been given from council to ensure that we're also funding community partners who are engaging in the work and culturally specific organizations, not only legal services.
Okay, great. So it's $100,000, the bar on here. You said there's already 50, is that subsumed within that?
So this graph represents funding for the 1920 fiscal year. We had 50,000 in the 1819 fiscal year for the pilot.
So that 50 has just become 100 now?
The 100 is for the coming fiscal year, the 50 is
for
the current.
Oh, right, 50 is a pilot that will sunset as of June 3rd. Okay, gotcha.
I had the same thought when doing this, yeah.
So it's not ongoing. Okay, great. Thank you.
And so this also is one-time funding, which means that the pilot will end unless additional funding is allocated.
Thanks.
So then on the final page, we have a breakdown of the rental services office's funding by source. So you will see that the largest amount is in one-time funding. What this means is when the council does its budget, when the budget office does the budget, they have an assessment of how much they confidently feel the city will have in ongoing revenue, and then anything that they're not confident will be continuous, they allowed to be spent on one-time funding, which means that there's no guarantee the funding will be there fiscal year after fiscal year. And so the overwhelming majority of the funding the office receives is in one-time funding. If you go back to the very first graphic with the steps and the green line, the overwhelming majority of the funding that the office has received from fiscal year 17-18 has been in one-time funding. And so each of those increases has been primarily an increase in one-time funding. Some of that around staffing has been converted to ongoing funds, but the majority of the services that are offered in the contracts are still one-time funds. So that explains why that's so large. There is a substantial portion of the services that comes from federal funds, that is most of the pre-existing contracts, particularly around fair housing, and then a small amount that has been guaranteed in ongoing funding. And then you can also see the one-time funding from the cannabis tax that was allocated for the expansion pilot.
Thank you.
Just to go back, I wanted to ask, do we have any detail right now in terms of what the mediation services pilot's going to look like for rollout?
Mm-hmm. So at this point, the approach we're taking is to, we've been in contact with Portland State University to explore the possibility of them helping us with program design. So we want to make sure that this pilot is created in a way that considers the best impact that we can have on mediation given the situation Portland's in. So we've engaged them around program design, which, if it moves forward, would have someone from Portland State creating the scope of the project and convening partners to receive input. From there, we would contract out the remainder of the funds to do mediation in line with the program design.
On the last slide, the funding by source, the federal funds, are those multi-year contracts? I mean, you've got ongoing one-time and then federal. Mm-hmm. Is the federal like other federal dollars where it lands somewhere between the one-time and the ongoing?
I think that's an accurate assessment.
Okay.
And so there have been graphics the Housing Bureau has used in the past for budget presentations that show that federal funds have generally been declining. And it kind of varies year to year how much federal funds there will be. So we use them for contracts that we hope will be ongoing, but at the same time, we have no guarantee that the funding will be there year after year. And we do our best to adjust accordingly.
Okay, thank you.
Is the thought process around this really large one-time amount of funding that when the registration process and the per unit fee gets going, that's going to largely go to fund this one-time funding?
That is the direction we've received from the mayor. Any other questions about any of the slides or the budget process or the recent budget cycle for the Housing Bureau?
I did have one more question, and my apologies if we had already clarified this, but there's been some confusion about the rental registration system, and what was funded, what wasn't. So can you clarify for us about rental registration and its associated computer software? So what's been funded for next year?
So council passed a requirement to make rental registration exist. In the first year, it didn't have a fee or penalty, and it's being done through a Schedule R out of the revenue division through business license taxes. That information can be given to the revenue division either on a paper form or an Excel document that they created, and then they are compiling it. From there, at some point, that information will be given to the Housing Bureau. The fields collected are more or less the owner, whoever filed their business taxes, the addresses of the units, and if the units have been dispossessed, one of the two. if they have sold the property. So those are the fields that are currently being collected. In, I believe, the fall bump of this past year, the Revenue Division received staffing for enforcement and just doing intake of the information received. So that funding was continued for the rental registration system as it stands today.
In the Revenue Department?
In the Revenue Division. Separate from that, in this budget cycle, the Housing Bureau received a directive to develop a proposal for procuring a rental registration system that could collect more information beyond what is currently collected by the Revenue Division. That was not funded in the budget for the coming fiscal year. So procuring a more expansive rental registration system with the ability to collect more robust information or to be separate from the business license was not funded and is not cannot happen without being procured. So the current system can't incorporate that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Of course. Okay. If anyone has questions afterwards, you are always more than welcome to follow up with me or Matt about the budget. So with that, we can move into the rental registration fee draft framework. So in the mayor's proposed budget, there was a budget note that directed the Housing Bureau and the Revenue Division to bring a rental registration fee proposal back to council in July. So the scheduled date for that is July 31st. And our plan at the moment is to engage the RSC at this month's meeting and next month's meeting to get input as we prepare a fee proposal with revenue to bring to council. You'll all remember that you all gave feedback as to the structure of the fee. We are still not engaging with a dollar amount, but we have developed a framework that we're using with the Revenue Division to develop a fee proposal. So at this point, that is what we have ready to bring to the commission and what we're asking for your input on. So this is also in your binders, but we put together a 6-part registration fee framework. The first component of the framework is that the fee is intended to provide full cost recovery for the rental services office. So this gets at Deborah's question before. The intent is, if you remember back to the funding levels that the rental services office is receiving, that all of that cost would be covered by a rental registration fee. And that's calibrated to be covered once the fee reaches terminal compliance. So revenue has experience in collecting fees and in compliance rates for fees and requirements set by council. And accordingly, they're developing a model of expected compliance rates over time. It's expected that in the first fiscal year, we won't have maximum compliance. And so there will be a need for one-time funding to continue until full compliance is reached for the program. But once revenues, once we reach where revenue expects we will hit compliance, that is when the cost should be borne entirely by a registration fee.
So with the data that has been collected so far, do we know how many units have been accounted for at this point? And what the Revenue Division perspective is on what the rate of compliance is at this point? And how many years do they expect it to take for us to get into full compliance?
So what are you asking about the current registration filing that's happened? So we've met with revenue and do not have complete numbers for business filings. It's common to receive extensions, and so they're expecting that they'll have an estimate on the past tax year's numbers by the end of this calendar year. And that until then, given the extensions given for business taxes, that they won't know for sure. And there is a second part to your question. Could you remind me?
I was just wondering what they estimated the first year's compliance level would be and when they thought that they would reach full compliance.
So they haven't settled on an exact number for first year compliance yet.
Okay. And do they know when they would anticipate, typically when rolling out a program like this, how long it would take to reach full compliance? Mm-hmm. Are we looking at 3-5 years?
I think 3 to 5 years is a reasonable window.
And just in terms of the, you said that it, the registration fee is then going to just cover everything that we're showing on that last slide for funding sources, is that correct? So are even the federal housing dollars going away?
At this time, that the plan is to cover for the federal funding sources, given the fact that federal funds have continued to decrease over time, they've become a less reliable funding source. And if the federal funds were to be replaced with a registration fee, once we get to that point, the funds would be reallocated for building affordable housing and other uses of federal funds by the city.
Okay.
The next component of the framework is that it is expected to include rental registration system costs for an expanded rental registration system. So the city has not allocated funding to procure a expanded rental registration system, but there is an expectation that at some point in the future it will. From looking into the registration systems that exist, there is some degree of consistency in annual maintenance costs, and those would be included within the rental registration fee. It would not cover procurement, but it would cover the annual costs of a system. I will follow up on that because I know we developed numbers in our budget proposal.
And I thought that those numbers did include procurement.
Mm-hmm.
I think the bulk of it was out of current costs.
Yes, so we developed a budget proposal and in it distinguished between the one-time procurement costs and the ongoing annual costs. And so I know we developed both of those numbers. The next component of the framework is that the fee would be a annual flat per unit fee, so it would be due annually. It lines up with recommendations from staff and other jurisdictions, as well as the recommendation that the RC made to council in March and April. And the thought process behind it is to create a fee that is simple to administer and easy to communicate to the public, so having clarity around a dollar amount per unit and having that be something that could be clearly put on materials and explained in trainings. Next, we expect that the registration fee will be adjusted moving forward to account for inflation or deflation, and those fees would adjust over time. The fifth component of the framework is that regulated affordable housing at 60 AMI and below would be exempt from paying the fee, and that exemption would be regardless of ownership. So we have some units that are being built at 60 AMI and below through inclusionary housing and other incentive programs, and so regardless of the ownership structure, whether that's private or public ownership of the units, that unit would be exempt from a fee. If it is regulated housing, regulated affordable housing at 60 AMI or below.
Can you talk a little more about the 60%, if there's more to talk about in terms of internal staff conversations?
Mm-hmm. I think it is part of an ongoing conversation about how to incentivize affordable housing that's needed the most and ensuring that we're not adding additional costs to very affordable housing.
Yeah. So I know that the LIHTC program now permits, I'm totally forgetting the technical term if anyone can remember it, but income scaling. So you could have, instead of all at 60%, you could have like half at 80 and half at 40 and it averages to 60. So was there any thought about that? I mean, I understand simplicity is one big thought here, but, you know, about if like a project or development averages out at 60% or the whole development is still federally LIHTC compliant, that there could be some, I don't know, consideration along these lines here. And, you know, the reason I ask is because, you know, there's a policy reason why mixed income housing is important that allows for higher than 60 and lower than 60. And I think it's pretty important given our nation's history of warehousing poverty. And so I wouldn't want to provide a disincentive to that if the impact on the system were similar around that 60% AMI benchmark. So just a thought. I know we didn't quite get to that level of discussion previously. So I wanted to offer, and this is a discussion. Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah, that's valuable feedback. Thank you.
Oh, income averaging is the term.
Thank you. And the last component of the framework is that funds would be used for the rental services office. So this funding wouldn't be put into general fund for redistribution by council. The funds would go directly to cover the program's expenses and costs of the rental services office. So with that, any feedback, any questions, anything that's missing?
While Jessica's considering whether she really wants to offer something right now, which I would encourage her to do, I'm just going to add a small little point on my last one, which is that OHCS has indicated that they will be permitting income averaging probably starting with 9% applications next year, and definitely with the 4% as soon as it be approved by the Housing Stability Council, which I think is late fall. So that is something that's not speculative. It is happening, and there is a tangible piece that at least OHCS could probably give more information on.
Thank you.
Sure.
So it's 5 years from now and there's a surplus, what will we do with the money?
That is a great question. I will ask it and get back to you.
Since we're talking about this. So the federal contracts that are received are often allocated towards specific purposes, which in this case is typically towards fair housing related items. So you mentioned earlier in the conversation that that could be reallocated to affordable housing or other instances. Is there any flexibility in those federal dollars, and are we at risk of losing those federal dollars if they're not utilized for that? Because obviously that's probably something we're applying for annually. And then if this fund itself exceeds, I mean, is used exclusively for those rental services, it's not like you can dip those funds elsewhere. So do you then discount the next year's fee? Like, how are you balancing? I have lots of questions about this.
I'm not expecting to have all the answers. There is an amount of flexibility with federal funds. They have a prescribed use, but they're generally in large categories. So the rental services office primarily uses community development block grant funding, and so that's the primary federal source for funds. And there is a little bit of flexibility between service provision and affordable housing there. So that is a degree of flexibility that exists there. I think it is important, and we definitely would be considering the effect on our ability to continue to receive federal funds, because that isn't funding. We don't want to lose that funding. We want to make sure it continues to be used in ways that are helpful. So that will be something that we're accounting for.
So if regulated affordable housing or it's exempt from paying the fee, are they still going to register so that we have the total count? Because part of the rental registration was, the concept was this idea that we would know how many units were out there.
They will still be required to register. At this time, there is no exemption from registration.
The fee exemption, but no exemption.
Yes. Good question.
Katrina, any questions or comments?
No. This time it sounds pretty straightforward. A lot of folks have asked the questions that I had thus far. Nothing coming up right now.
Public comment?
Do we know if we have any public testimony, Stacey?
There's nobody signed in.
Nobody signed in? Is there anybody in the room that wants to provide testimony? Okay. If anybody changed their mind, just let us know. We'll move on to the next regular agenda item, education and training RFQ.
So I want to apologize to the group because this and the previous document were not provided with the meeting materials, given the timelines that have been associated with the budget process and our director's schedule. We weren't able to get these finalized in time to send out. So I want to give you all a chance to look over this before I begin discussing it. So in your binders, you'll have the education and training RFQ draft scope. And it begins with a little bit of context and then the scope itself. So maybe everyone takes 5 minutes to look that over and then I'll walk you through.